That was The Hardest Button to Button by White Stripes. This is Sound and Vision on Six Music with me, Miranda Sawyer, and I'm here talking to Cillian Murphy. Hello, Cillian.
Hi, Miranda.
Hello. So we played that song because it features in the first season of Peaky Blinders, which we're going to be talking about later, but I'd just like to refer to exactly where it was, just so you know. Can you remember?
No.
I knew you wouldn't be able to. Luckily, I can. So it features in the first series, in episode 2, as Tommy burns all the pictures of the kings.
Oh, yes.
So you remember that bit?
I do.
Okay, fine.
Yeah.
But we're not allowed to talk about that yet. We're going to talk instead later about Peaky Blinders, which returned this week to great fanfare, huh?
Yeah. People were excited.
I was excited. Shall we start, though, with 28 Days Later?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what we're going to start with. How did you get involved with 28 Days Later?
In the most kind of traditional manner, I got sent the script, or my agent got sent the script, and went through a series of auditions with Danny Boyle. He put me through like 5 auditions, I think, and I was desperate to do it because, you know, I grew up watching Danny Boyle movies, and they were hugely influential to me in my kind of like mid-late teens, you know, like many, many people out there. And so it put me through the ringer on that one, and eventually it worked out.
What kind of thing did you have to do in the auditions?
I mean, I think because the character goes on, he starts off kind of like we think he's dead, or it's like a rebirth or something, and then he's kind of this sort of like he doesn't know anything, you know, and then by the end he has to be this killer.
Yeah.
So I think he wanted to see if whoever he cast could make that jump from being kind of everyday bike courier to sort of, you know, zombie killer by the end.
Blood-soaked zombie killer.
Yeah.
And also, it was a long time ago, that film. It's like 2003.
Yeah.
So it's quite hard to think of it then, but you were not known. And, you know, neither was Naomi Harris. Mm-hmm. You were kind of low-key, weren't you? And that was quite important for the casting as well, I think.
Yeah, I think he wanted that the sort of protagonists would be people that you could just project your own personality onto, that they didn't come with baggage or anything, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that you wouldn't have known them from other things. And he was very clear that that's what he wanted to do, you know, and even the sort of aesthetic of the film, like shot on like a sort of domestic
video,
wasn't it? Yeah. Which, you know, you could get in the high street, you know. That's what he wanted it to be. So it was almost like they were filming it themselves running around, you know.
Yeah, quite a kind of, low-key feel.
Mm.
But should we play the music? What we're going to play is, it's Brian Eno, An Ending, Ascent. And this is actually, in the film, it plays when the 4 kind of main characters, including you, are travelling up to Manchester, and they stop to eat and they see some horses. It's like a hopeful, hopeful scene.
Yeah. I remember Danny played me this piece of music, which I'd never heard before. I was kind of aware of Eno, but like, he played me this piece of music, and it knocked me out, and he said, I think I'm going to use this here.
Great, let's hear it. So that was An Ending Ascent by Brian Eno, which featured in 28 Days Later. And now we're going to move on to another Danny Boyle film, mm-hmm. which is Sunshine. Very different.
Yes.
Amazingly different. And I imagine kind of quite hard to film, because I don't imagine they did shoot you up into space towards the sun.
No. No. Also written by Alex Garland, this that film.
Yeah.
There was some green screen, but most of that was shot for real, like all of the stuff
inside.
On the suits and like fixing the shield and all of that. And so, like, one of the longest shoots I've ever been on. We all shot it down in 3 mils down in East London. But I've not seen that film in a while, but I remember it being very, very, very beautiful the way how Danny made it look. You know?
Yes, it is very beautiful, but it's incredibly intense. You know, that's essentially the story is you are in a kind of spaceship, a rocket going off to the sun on almost a suicide mission. So you're in Icarus 2, the sun is dying, you're going to put a nuclear bomb in there and kind of reawaken it.
Yeah.
And on the way, you hear a distress signal from the first kind of set of astronauts that were sent out there, and from Icarus 1, and your character says we should go and save them, and it all goes a bit wrong.
It does go a bit wrong, yeah.
And it becomes actually one like those survival films, doesn't it? You know, where you have people in a boat, who eats who first?
Yeah.
And because your character is a physicist, actually, you last the longer. There are points where people are choosing who has to die.
Yeah.
And you don't.
Well, I don't want to give it away.
But maybe not. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I loved that script. I remember because it was, it's a conventional enough setup as you described, and that's a very traditional setup for a science fiction sort of space movie. But then I think it really also managed to smuggle in like these questions about science versus religion, and I found that really, really interesting. And at the time, I based the character on Professor Brian Cox, who was not yet then a famous, justifiably famous and brilliant man, but he was just sort of a professor in Manchester, you know. And so we hung out a lot during before we shot the film and during it. And he was the most helpful and amusing and brilliant. I actually based a lot of the mannerisms off him for the character as well.
Yeah.
I still love watching him on the telly. So we were trying to make, I guess, a sort of a film that was kind of philosophical.
Yeah. You know? The composer between 28 Days Later and Sunshine is John Murphy. But in this particular film, in Sunshine, he worked with Underworld. Mm. So Underworld were given the film, then they did their soundtrack, then he kind of took it in and rejigged it.
Yeah.
I think perhaps we should hear John Murphy, and then later on we'll hear Underworld. But John Murphy, this is actually called Sunshine, Adagio in D minor, and that's taken from the soundtrack to Sunshine.
Thank you.
So that was Underworld, Tahil Kapa Meets the Sun. So that was the track.
There you go.
that you found so moving at the end of Sunshine, a completely epic moment.
Yeah.
The concept.
Feminist sci-fi movie.
A happy, bubbly one.
The tagline.
If we ever needed utopia where nature and technology can collaborate, it's now.
The cliffhanger.
That's me, like, revealing my biggest weakness to you.
Escape into the mind, the dreams, and the revelations of the elemental Bjork.
The core of music is that it's spontaneous and that it's tied into how you feel. I was fantasizing when I was a kid I would, like, be doing your job.
Radio DJ.
And I'd have a radio show where I would tell people about music they hadn't heard.
Bjork, with me, Lauren Levin.
Would you like to hear this?
Tuesday morning from 10.
I'm BBC.
On BBC Radio 6.
Music.
I am here with Cillian Murphy and we are talking music and films for Sound and Vision. And we're going to move on to Batman Begins. That is a big move, isn't it, to go and make a Batman film with Christopher Nolan, and the soundtrack is done by Hans Zimmer, which we'll talk about in a bit. But to move into those films, that's like, it's opening a door you can't shut again, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I suppose so. I mean, I didn't really think about it like that. I was a fan of Chris Nolan from Memento and Insomnia, and then I went back and watched Following.
Yeah.
So I was like just, you know, thrilled to be in a room with him, and the sort of Batman thing was was like secondary, really.
Yes, because you just wanted to meet this amazing director.
Yeah. And then, you know, we met and we got on and... then he just you know, took this franchise and completely turned it on its head and reinvented it and did amazing work with it, you know. And I just feel really lucky to be part of it in a small way, you know.
Yeah. And do you want to talk about your character then? If you had to describe your character, my mum, how would you describe
it? Well, his real name is Jonathan Crane, and he's a doctor. Like a psychiatrist, and but then he's got this alter ego where he's a scarecrow, and he puts, basically, it sounds a bit rubbish, but he puts a burlap sack over his head, and that's about it. But no, but he's one of the oldest DC villains. I think he was out in some of the really really early comics, and. But he sprays these people with this toxin that he's created called a fear gas. So therefore, that burlap mask looks absolutely horrific and terrifying. And it actually began a sort of a tradition in my work with Chris Nolan, where he puts a sack over my head in almost every film. I think in almost every film, bar one, he puts a sack over my head.
That's nice. You go there and say, oh, this is a sack moment. Thanks
a lot. Moment. Yeah.
And you've worked with him for a lot of films now. When you have a relationship like that with a director, is it one where when you hear he's going to make a film, I mean, not necessarily within the Batman franchise, because then you know that the other character may well reappear, but if he's making another film, do you think, ooh, I hope is that going to be for me? Because I really like him. Are we really good friends? I mean, do you phone him up and say, can I be in it? Or?
No, it's the first one. It's the first one. Oh, God, please. And then sometimes you get the call and sometimes you don't, you know. I feel really lucky that he has on occasion called and said, look, there's this part I think is right. But you never, you never can tell. But I think the reason that people re-collaborate is more to do with sort of like a shorthand, an understanding and a trust, you know, to do with going, right, well, we did this before and it worked, and we know, you know how I work and I know how you work, so when we can go straight to the work, you know. And there's none of this sort of first day of school, getting to know everyone thing, which happens a lot in films. It's like going to sort of summer camp or changing school. It's that awkward, like, you know, thing that you get. But when you work with someone over a number of years and over a number of films, that disappears. So when you meet, you go straight to the work. And I think it helps in getting the best work from people. And he's, you know, kept a lot of his crew and key creative people close to him. And obviously he has a sort of a... a group of actors that he works with a lot, you know.
Okay, well, look, we should play, let's play one of the tracks from the score of Batman Begins. So this is it's a Hans Zimmer and James Newton Howard track called Molossus. And this is the first film that Hans Zimmer, who's obviously an incredibly established soundtrack writer and, you know, composer, it's the first time he works with Chris Nolan, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And then he seems to have used him for kind of everything.
Yeah, every movie since, I think, yeah.
Yeah, and it's an epic track. So shall we hear it? This is Molossus. That was Time by Hans Zimmer. After the news, we'll be talking more to Cillian Murphy, including discussing Peaky Blinders, of course. I'm Miranda Sawyer, but now it's time for the Six Music News.
Six Music. This is BBC Radio.
Six Music.
BBC News at 1:30, I'm James Kelly. The beleaguered president of Zimbabwe, Robert Mugabe, has been sacked as leader of his party, ZANU-PF. Earlier, the head of Zimbabwe's powerful Liberation War Veterans Movement warned of mob violence on the streets if Mr. Mugabe failed to step down as president today. Chris Mutsvangwa stressed that matters were likely to get much worse for the president if he continued to cling on to power.
It had not been for the military yesterday. By this time, it would be a typical African coup. Somebody's head would be hanging off the tree or something like that, and that's not what we want here in Zimbabwe. You saw the order, you saw the discipline, you saw no looting, no nothing. That's the Zimbabwean way of doing things. I hope he also realized that the Zimbabwean way of doing things is for him to give in quickly so that the situation does not get any more aggravated than it is right now.
The Chancellor, Philip Hammond, has said that he'll set out measures in this week's budget to get 300,000 homes built a year. He said he would stop developers from delaying construction once planning permission had been granted. The Shadow Chancellor, John McDonnell, has said Labour would launch a £250 billion investment programme over a 10-year period. He insisted the investment would more than pay for itself in the longer term and was needed to support the British economy.
If we don't do that, we will not be able to keep up with our international competitors. And what that happens, you know as well as I do, when you invest those sums, look at what the recent report by PwC, you get a return on that investment that covers any cost of borrowing.
A British sailor has died in a round-the-world yacht race. Organisers say Simon Spears, who's 60 and from Bristol, was washed overboard, throwing the leg between South Africa and Australia. The broadcaster Alec Jones says he won't be appearing on the BBC while allegations of inappropriate behaviour are investigated. A spokesperson said he accepted the way he acted more than a decade ago was occasionally juvenile, but he strongly denied any inappropriate contact and said he never intended to harass or cause any distress. And that's the Six Music News. The next update's at 2:30.
Six.
This
is BBC Radio.
Six Music.
Six Music.
Let's move on to Inception, which is another Christopher Nolan film and actually also involves Hans Zimmer. This is a kind of amazing film, isn't it? It's so... It unpacks all the things that kind of seem to have been started by Memento, this idea of time and dreams and reality. And you could kind of watch this film over and over again and still not quite work out who and where and what is happening. Shall we explain what happens at the beginning? Would you like to explain?
Oh, God. It's basically, in its simple form, it's a heist movie, really. Mm. You know, it involves going Leonardo DiCaprio and his gang of, like... people who are brilliant at very specific things, like most heist gang members are, they have to go inside of my head. So I'm like the Mark in the movie, and they have to get me to do something. And he has to do that in order to protect his children. So that's the sort of basic setup, but it's obviously hugely complicated. The interesting thing about this is that Chris had this movie in his head for many, many, many years before he made it. And it was only the success of the Batman franchise that, you know, the studio went, now
you can make it.
Yeah, so, you know, and then he had this huge palette to work with and then made this kind of extraordinary film, which you think shouldn't work as a blockbuster, because surely this is a little arthouse film, but it works on that scale amazingly well.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think once you've described it as a heist movie, I think, oh, yes, of course, and that's why you get so engaged and that's why you can have kind of chase sequences and amazing fight sequences. But it's couched in this idea that you're actually going through different levels of dream sequences. Your character is interesting, isn't it? Because your character essentially has to change very subtly through the film, but with almost without realising that he's changing. But he is the son of a very important person.
Yeah.
How did you go about kind of deciding how to play that particular character?
Well, we kind of... I talked a lot with Chris about it, and we kind of took it off the Murdoch dynasty, you know, because he's got two sons. I can't remember their names now, but...
Lachlan and another one.
Right. And... So, you know, it's the thing of living in the shadow. I mean, it's not just applicable to Murdoch, empire or dynasty, but it's applicable to anyone living in the shadow of a hugely successful, powerful father, you know, and having everything materially but having nothing sort of emotionally. So we kind of based it off that. And then, yeah, he had to have this sort of moment with his father, which was played by the wonderful... And, you know, sadly missed Pete Postlethwaite. It's a great film because it manages, again, within that very sort of sophisticated, complex structure to make something very emotional, you know, I think.
It is, yes, it is very emotional. I suppose what I wanted to ask you really is the role of music in film. I feel we should talk about this. Do you get given music to listen to when you make a film like that? Or do you have music in your head? Or does that ever help?
Yeah, it does. I mean, it depends on the project. With Chris's films, you know, you generally turn up and do the work, and then a year later you see the finished thing with the score and everything, and it just knocks you out. And other films, you know, smaller films, or, for example, Peaky Blinders, you'd be much more involved, and you might, you know, use the music on set, or you'd be involved in the sort of curation of the sort of music or whatever. But, yeah, I mean, to me, they're so closely linked... you know, and the power, you can see the power of a score, and what it can do to the images you're seeing and what it can then do to the audience as a result. And, you know, and it's the thing of not telegraphing, because that's not a good thing if you're telling the audience how to feel, but it can enhance the emotion that you're supposed to be experiencing, you know, I think.
Okay, let's play it. This is Time by Hans Zimmer.
Six Music.
These days you can catch up on just about anything.
Stream this, download that.
But what if you miss a breakfast show and don't have time to listen to the whole 3 hours? Plus it would mean you'd be missing out on and then having to catch up on all of your other favourite Six Music shows, therefore entering a never-ending cycle of catching up. So to help bring you back up to speed, here's a handy bite-sized version of that show that you missed, or pretty much any one of my shows. What are you looking at?
We don't do birthdays.
Halfway through?
How's that happened? Have you got any music news?
We have got music news.
Top 10 cities of the United Kingdom
that least like pastry.
The Sean Keaveney Breakfast Show.
Back Monday morning at 7 on BBC Radio 6 Music.
That was Shivering Soldier by Hans Zimmer from the film Dunkirk. I'm Miranda Sawyer, this is Sound and Vision, and I'm talking to Cillian Murphy, and suddenly someone has appeared. Hello, Anthony again.
Hello there, Miranda Sawyer. How are you?
I am fine. So, you are here because we are now about to talk about Peaky Blinders, which I have a feeling that everybody's just been waiting the whole show to talk about. Peaky Blinders, it's back. Hooray. You are here because you do the soundtrack with Martin Slattery, who's ex-Mescaleros, for Peaky Blinders.
Indeed.
And also, there's a whole strain of music, perfect six music that goes through the show, that changes the show from something that seems like obviously set in a very particular period. It's very truthful to that time. A lot of the characters are actually exist, but it changes it into something that you can completely relate to, I think, don't you?
Yeah, well, I think the DNA of Peaky Blinders comes from Nick Cave and also the music of Nick Cave and Warren Ellis. And there's a lineage through that. Was PJ Harvey and White Stripes and many other people. But when I first went up to speak to Cillian and the director David Caffrey in Manchester, the word that really was our watchword, if you like, was outlaw. Tommy Shelby is an outlaw. These are outlaws. And musically, these people are outlaws. Nick Cave is an outlaw.
Yeah.
You know, no question. PJ Harvey is an outlaw. You know, and our friend Flood, who was involved doing season two, he is very much an outlaw also.
Yeah.
And we love outlaws, don't we?
It's definitely
what we love. So I think that, you know, that lineage is there. So coming in at season four, we had that as a template.
Yeah.
And I think that that is really what Peaky is about.
Yeah. What do you think? How important is the music for you when you're making Peaky Blinders, Cillian?
Well, I think that, you know, every year it's kind of had a sort of a tone to it. You know, every year it's definitely had a different vibe. You know, I think in series two, you know, we had PJ Harvey, who was a kind of a more feminine approach to it. And then I think season three was... I don't know, it was kind of sadder. It was just, there was quite a lot of tragedy in that. And then this series, it feels like we're going back to a lot of what happened in, or the energy of series one, you know. And we wanted to have a very coherent score all the way through, you know. So Ant and Martin, like, are writing and creating their own score, which sort of moves between the commercial tracks that are in there and the sort of, these amazing cover versions that Ant has got people to do. So it's very coherent all the way through. Do you know what I mean? But it always, it's weird now. It has, this sound has this kind of peakiness to it. You just know if it's peaky or not, right?
Yeah, we say that all the time in the studio. Yeah, it's good, that one sounds really peaky.
So do you come in? Do you, like, Cillian, you come in and say, I've heard this track, we must put it in.
No, I don't actually, because, you know, I trust the guys that are doing the music, you know, like, because they're such legends, to be able to find the tracks that are needed or to create the tracks that are needed. But obviously we'd have the conversations around that about who we love and who we admire and who would be a sort of a peaky artist and who wouldn't.
You know? Who would you give an example of that's used in this series then that you said, oh, they're peaky?
Well, right from the beginning, I thought it was like Savages would have been brilliant, and they're used, right?
Yeah. I mean, Savages are pure outlaw, man.
They're pure peaky.
They are so peaky. Well, you know, have you seen them play? They are alive and vibrant and have got that. They're in touch with something so visceral. There's those. And then we also wanted it to evolve because, you know, Tommy's evolving, the story evolves, the characters evolve, and the music should evolve.
Yeah.
And that's why, from the beginning, me and Cillian talked about bringing in people to do, you know, new versions of certain tracks.
Yeah.
And obviously Red Right Hand being one of them. And there's three different versions. So talking about Iggy and Jarvis, I mean, obviously part of that is just me thinking to myself, how can I do a track with someone legendary like Iggy Pop? I know, like this. And of course, Jarv knows Iggy. So I called Jarv and said, what about you and Iggy doing a version of Red Right Hand, and Jarvis like, yeah, that sounds good.
It's very Six Music, isn't it? It couldn't be more Six.
It couldn't be more Six Music family. Keep it in the family, baby. So we made it happen. It was amazing, and you know, Jarv came into our studio. We did it on a thing called Source Connect. So Iggy was in Miami, and the music was coming out live, and we had a screen, and we were talking to Iggy, and he's like, he goes, "Who's there at the other side?" He goes, "My name's Ant." He goes, "What, ant? Like an insect?" I was like, "Yeah." And like, it's okay, cool. And then you're thinking, well, how do you produce Iggy Pop? It's like, I know how you produce Iggy Pop. You just let him be Iggy Pop, man. You know, he goes, okay, I'm going to do a couple of takes like this and a couple of takes like that, and then we'll see how we feel. And that's pretty much what we did. And, you know, threw a couple of ideas in, and it was an amazing experience. And Jarv, later on that day, Jarv sent me a text saying that, I just did a track with Iggy Pop. Because, you know, we're just kids from Sheffield, man.
Yeah.
You know, grew up listening to music. We're music fans. You know, that's why me and Kill, you know, connected years ago when we met, because Killian is such a music obsessive, and we're all just music junkies. It's in our blood. It's what we love. It's, you know, so to sit there and see Iggy Pop on a little computer screen talking to me and going, is that an ant? You know, it was a pretty amazing experience.
Okay, well, I think we should hear it. This is Red Right Hand by Iggy Pop and Jarvis Cocker from the new season of Peaky Blinders.
Take a little walk to the edge of town. Go across the tracks. Where the viaduct looms like a bird of doom as it shifts.
Of the Iggy Pop and Jarvis Cocker version of Red Right Hand. And then there's another version that we're going to play again now.
There is.
This is a whole world of Red Right Hand, isn't there? Okay, well, what about this one? This is by Laura Marling.
Yeah, because Laura Marling is all. So an outlaw. Being an outlaw is not about being loud. Being an outlaw is about being powerful. And when Laura Marling opens her mouth and sings, and honestly, we were in the studio and she was just sat next to us working it out on the guitar. Me and Martin were looking at each other like, whoa.
Yeah, she's amazingly
honestly
talented.
You know, they say that thing is that this person is the real deal. And it was one of the most magical days I think either of us ever had in the studio. And we've worked with some interesting people over the years and had some amazing times in music and been very privileged to do that. But it was pretty special, I've got to tell you. And she killed it.
Yeah.
She killed it. And she also did another track, which is going to feature later on, but we're not going to tell you what that is because we've got to have some surprises. But she did another track later on. And she has another track of hers in the show as well also. So we're Laura Marling-tastic.
Okay, that's great. Let's hear it.
Take a walk to the edge of town and go across the tracks. Where the viaduct looms like a bird of doom as it shifts and cracks. Where secrets lie in the border fires and the humming wise. Hey man, you're never coming back. Past the square, past the bridge, past the mills, past the stacks. On a gathering storm comes a tall, handsome man in a dusty black coat with a red right hand. Red right hand. The red right hand.
That was Red Right Hand by Laura Marling. This is Sound and Vision on Six Music. I'm Miranda Sawyer and I'm here talking Peaky Blinders and music with Ant Gen and Cillian Murphy. I think we should hear some more music, shouldn't we? Shall we hear Mercy Seat by Nick Cave? Do you want to explain about this particular version, Ant?
Well, I won't spoil it for you where it comes in the series, but it's an incredibly powerful moment when it comes. And I just wanted to find another Nick Cave song, and this is a radio version that they did live on KCRW. If anyone's... The Mercy Seat is a weird thing because the recording of Mercy Seat, original recording, is pretty weird. It's a pretty weird kind of very reverb-y recording, and then when you see it live, it's one of the greatest things you will ever see. If the only artist that you see ever again in your life is Nick Cave and Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, then do it before you die, because he is, for me, one of the greatest front men, one of the greatest artists that has ever lived. And I'm not saying that because I'm choosing a Nick Cave song. I've seen it so many times, it's incredible. And this version is just so emotional and beautiful. It's just piano and the amazing Warren Ellis on viola. It's mind-blowing. And here we go.
I began to warm and chill to objects in the fields. A ragged cup, a twisted mop, the face of Jesus in my soup, those sinister dinner deals, the meal trolley's wicked wheels, and the mercy seat is awaiting, and I think my head is burning, in a way I'm yearning to be done with all this weighing up the truth, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and anyway I told the truth, and I'm not afraid to die, and the mercy seat is burning. And I think my head is glowing, in a way I'm hoping to be done with all this weighing up a truth, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and anyway I told the truth, but I'm afraid I told a lie.
Yeah, we're going to finish with a Savages track called The Door, which was on the first episode of this new series of Peaky Blinders. But I suppose what I'd like to ask is what we can expect. I don't want any spoilers, because it's not going to work, is it? I don't want any spoilers from what's going to happen in the series. But I suppose what we can expect musically and what we can expect emotionally from this series.
I can talk a little bit, I suppose, about the emotion. And I think that, you know, this is where we all know this from families, you know, where you kind of have to work together, and when a crisis or a loss or something happens, and all the family is forced to just put aside differences and grudges and everything and get together. And that's really what you see happen over the course of this. And some people become much closer as a result of it, and some people get pushed even further apart, you know. So that's really all I'd say. I know that's vague enough, but I really don't want to give anything
away. It's fine, I'm already excited, that's good. And what about musically, Ant?
Well, you know, the music is there to serve the story, and the story has got so many twists and turns that for us as musicians and writers, it was so exciting and interesting to be able to navigate that. So musically, it's all over the map. You know, there's some things that are heartbreaking and beautiful, and some things are filthy and, you know, really blood and guts. We worked with this string quartet called Dirty Pretty Strings, these amazing four girls. Really, that's the essence of it. It's dirty and filthy, and it's pretty and beautiful, and everything in between.
Yeah, brilliant. Okay. Well, thank you very much. It's been really lovely to talk to you again and Cillian Murphy about music and films and all things sound and vision. We're going to finish off with Adore by Savages.
If funny I didn't want the world. I wouldn't make you feel so sad. I'm sure my shame would be gone. Is it human to do?
BBC Radio 6 Music.
Tonight from 6, now playing with Tom Robinson.
BBC 6 Music.
At 4, Cillian Murphy's Sunday Service. Right now, it's Guy Garvey's Finest Hour.